A cycling team in Gaza was training for the Paralympics. Now they're using their bikes to deliver food and humanitarian aid.
The general spirit on the ground is we might as well die doing something than die doing nothing.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman, also the former president of Honduras in a U.S. court, guilty of drug trafficking. He also partnered with the American government.
If you are working with an administration, a regime that is connected to drug trafficking, why not break off those relations? So that is a lingering question.
And why the art of sound design is essential for film.
To me, the film is trying to make an experience. And when you have the right sound for the right picture and the right moment, everything combines.
Combining for an Academy Award, that's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Good to have you with us. There was hope of reaching a ceasefire in Gaza before today, the first day of Ramadan, but negotiations are stuck. So the first 12 hours of fasting during the Islamic holy month began with no signs of a peaceful breakthrough anytime soon.
Nearly 2 billion Muslims across the globe celebrate Ramadan with spiritual reflection, donations to charities, and fasting. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said on social media that he's thinking about those in conflict zones, especially Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
In these trying times, the spirit of Ramadan is a beacon of hope, a reminder of our shared humanity. Let us all be inspired to heal divisions, to support those in need, and to work as one for the safety and dignity of every member of the human family.
The UN says at least a quarter of Gaza's population of more than 2 million people is a step away from famine, and that virtually everyone in the territory needs food.
The U.S. military has now carried out 3 airdrops of humanitarian aid into Gaza. The NGO World Central Kitchen says it has 200 pallets of food waiting to be shipped there. Getting the basic necessities to people in need has become very difficult. In Gaza, there's one unlikely group working to deliver goods themselves. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
Last summer, members of the Gaza Sunbird cycling team cheered during a training ride. Athletes on the team range in age from 12 to 45, but they share a common past.
They are a group of individuals who have lost their limbs to the aggression of the occupation.
Karim Ali co-founded the paracycling group in 2020.
So a lot of them have had their legs shot off or blown up by bombs falling.
Many of the athletes were injured during what's called the Great March of Return, a series of demonstrations in 2018 and 2019 calling for the end of the Israeli blockade and the right of return for refugees. Other Gaza Sunbirds team members were victims of what Ali calls more silent violence, a lack of advanced medical care in Gaza.
And so a lot of our athletes, their injuries have just been as a result of the fact they couldn't go out to get treatment for preventable conditions. So they've had to go on and get amputations.
Ali, who has Palestinian heritage and is now based in London, says the Gaza Sunbirds crowdfunded enough money to provide athletes with bikes and coaches. Their ultimate dream was to compete at the 2024 Paris Paralympics. Cycling also gave team members crucial access to transportation, which Ali says is hard to come by for people with disabilities in Gaza.
There's no public transportation, cars are super expensive, and so for someone with a disability, to walk from point A to point B on their crutches is a really difficult thing to do.
Moving around has become exponentially more difficult since October 7th, when Hamas attacked southern Israel and sparked the latest round of violence. Ala al-Dali, captain of the Gaza Sunbirds, took to social media in the first few days of the war. Speaking from Rafah, the southernmost city in Gaza, al-Dali shared how difficult the situation was and that nobody felt safe inside their own homes. Overnight, the Sunbirds' Paralympic dream took a back seat, but their bikes remained useful. Gaza Sunbirds athlete Mohammed Abu Asfor said on social media that he used his bike to escape after a bomb hit his neighborhood in Han Yunis. Soon, the team started using some of their crowdfunded money to buy bread and distribute it by bike to people in need. It wasn't long before a full-blown food operation was underway. Team co-founder Karim Ali helps organize from London.
We do like 300 parcels, 400 parcels, 500 parcels. Each parcel is like, you know, for like a family for a few days. And we've just been doing that consistently.
Ali says the Gaza Sunbirds have now distributed more than $100,000 worth of food on their bikes. The athletes on the ground haggle with local vendors for the best price and show it all to their growing social media following. One video shows team members handing out bags of flour. Another shows the Sunbirds working with local chefs to cook 900 hot meals. Ali says they've distributed other supplies, too, like sanitary products and blankets. Last month, they decided to hand out toys to kids.
The guys, after speaking to a lot of the kids and the war kind of picking up, they said, okay, you know, we have to do something for kids. We gave away like 140 toys to different kids and families.
Since October, Ali has also helped launch solidarity bike rides around the world and a campaign called Athletes for Palestine. It's an effort to rally support among the international sporting community.
Their cause, their culture, speaks directly to me.
George Cadado, a U.S.-born cyclist of Palestinian descent, is one of the 100 athletes who have signed on from across the globe. He says as harrowing as the videos coming out of Gaza are, he sees resilience and strength in the Gaza Sunbirds.
Bismillah. كيف عملت لعبة الحصان اللي في ايدك هذه؟
In one post, team member Hassam Suleiman plays with his young daughter outside. Her toys are shoes fashioned out of tin cans. Suleiman then takes her for a ride on his bike.
كيفك مبسوطة على العجلة؟ حلو الدراجة؟
Smiling, she says she's happy on the bike and wishes for one of her own. The reality is that about 80% of the Gaza Sunbirds have been displaced since October. Ali says most are living in tents in Rafah.
And so we don't have that like wide range of distribution anymore. People are scattered. They don't know where their families are. People don't have cell signal. They don't have electricity.
Still, he says about 10 team members keep going out to deliver food on their bikes.
No one knows when the bomb is going to hit, when it's going to drop or anything like that. And so the general spirit on the ground is we might as well die doing something than die doing nothing. And it gives them a little bit of a purpose.
As for their original goal, going to the Paralympics someday, Ali says the dream is very much alive. They're even hoping to get some athletes out to competitions by the end of the year. But for now, the Gaza Sunbirds are staying put and will keep distributing whatever food and supplies they can get their hands on. For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The small island nation of Vanuatu is in the South Pacific, about 6,000 miles from the U.S. mainland. But U.S. Coast Guard forces are now patrolling the waters there. They've been looking for ships, mainly Chinese vessels, fishing illegally, even stopping and boarding them. It's all part of a new U.S. Coast Guard operation to confront China on the high seas. The world's Patrick Nguyen has the story. Patrick, normally the Coast Guard sticks closer to American shores. Why are they hunting for Chinese vessels in the middle of the Pacific?
Well, the U.S. Coast Guard, unlike the Navy or the Air Force, doesn't have an obvious role to play in the U.S.-China rivalry, but it wants one. So what it's doing is going to these tiny island countries deep in the Pacific and saying to their government, you know, you don't have much of a Coast Guard, but you've got big remote seas to patrol. We can put your security forces on our boats, and essentially the U.S. will be your Coast Guard for short stints. It's called a ship rider agreement. The U.S. Coast Guard has set up deals with 12 island countries in the Pacific, Vanuatu, Kiribati, Micronesia. Some of these countries have less land than a big American city, but really vast waters. So the U.S. Coast Guard will take these local officers out on patrol, and they mainly end up going after Chinese fishing vessels, making sure they're not illegally fishing.
So the Coast Guard is stopping and boarding these Chinese fishing vessels. Can you describe how that works?
Yeah, it'll be a well-armed U.S. Coast Guard ship called a cutter with 50-caliber machine guns and turret guns that can fire big shells that could potentially rip through steel. This is a ship that would normally be going after drug traffickers off the coast of Florida, but it will pull up on a Chinese fishing boat, which is also quite big, and U.S. personnel will demand to come aboard always with the local police or military. So just 2 weeks ago, the U.S. Coast Guard went into the waters of Vanuatu and caught a Chinese boat that was allegedly taking fish without paying the proper fees. I talked to James Batley. He's a former Australian diplomat in the Pacific Islands, now at Australian National University. And he said the U.S. can do this because a country like Vanuatu and its police are the ones actually lodging any criminal charges.
That's a really important safeguard mechanism. Everyone is clear that it's Vanuatu law that is being enforced here.
Okay, so that's kind of how the U.S. Coast Guard has jurisdiction, if you want to say that, in this matter. I gather if the U.S. is extending itself to this faraway area, this must be a pretty big problem, these illegal fishing boats. Is that right?
It is. China consumes one-third of all the world's fish that is caught. Beijing-backed companies send thousands upon thousands of fishing boats out into the seas to collect all that fish. And increasingly, they end up in the waters of tiny countries that can't really do decent patrols. Doesn't mean that all the Beijing-subsidized ships are illegally fishing, but many are. This new U.S. Coast Guard operation has already caught 6 Chinese ships accused of illegal fishing just in the waters of Vanuatu. They're just getting started. It looks like this year you'll see the Coast Guard going out with more countries' police, places like Papua New Guinea or the Marshall Islands. But it does set the stage for more armed U.S. personnel in distant waters coming face to face with captains and crew who ultimately answer to Beijing.
And how has the Chinese government reacted so far?
Pretty muted so far. China's government says that those boats caught in Vanuatu's waters had all the right permits and that in general, Beijing has zero tolerance for any fleets doing any illegal fishing.
And what are the risks here when you have U.S. Coast Guard ships, you know, coming up against state-owned fishing boats from China? It sounds like there could be potential for unintended consequences.
Yeah, it's delicate. Traditionally, Beijing is pretty protective of its fishing crews and has even incorporated them into its own paramilitary operations, like using fishing boats to swarm an area Beijing wants to control. So these crews are something a little more than typical fishermen. I asked James Batley if he saw any serious risks on the horizon.
There is no doubt that this enforcement action involving the U.S. Coast Guard against Chinese fishing vessels, it does contribute to geostrategic tensions in this part of the world.
And to his point, the U.S. Navy and U.S. Air Force, they are already skirmishing with Chinese forces in the South China Sea, for example. China claims that whole area. The U.S. disagrees, and U.S. warships have had near collisions with Chinese warships in those waters. So what we see now is the U.S. Coast Guard coming into the mix in a different part of the Pacific, adding to the overall tension. If U.S. personnel were to manhandle or injure a member of a Chinese crew, we could expect Beijing to retaliate or react.
The World's Asia correspondent, Patrick Nguyen, based in Bangkok. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Carolyn.
13 years ago today, Japan was dealing with nuclear disaster. An earthquake, then a tsunami, killed nearly 20,000 people and triggered a triple meltdown at a nuclear power plant in Fukushima. Most of the residents who were evacuated from the area have now returned home, but there are still no-go zones in several towns near the power plant.
Last August, operators of the plant began releasing treated radioactive wastewater into the sea. Locals and neighboring countries have protested the releases, but so far, daily seawater sampling results have met safety standards. Fukushima's fishing industry has also returned, though it's much smaller than it was before the disaster.
Several hundred tons of melted nuclear fuel remain inside 3 damaged reactors in Fukushima. Japanese officials say it will take decades to remove it.
You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Salmon is one of the slabs of protein you expect to see on a restaurant menu right next to steak. But there are big questions about the way the fish are being raised at the industrial farming level. Hundreds of millions of salmon have died off over the years. Last year's loss was especially notable, suggesting the scale of these events is getting worse. Gerald Singh led a recent study about this. He's an assistant professor at the University of Victoria in Canada. What sort of frequency are we talking about with these mass die-offs, Gerald? These mass die-offs of salmon, how often are they happening?
We looked at six different nations that cover about over 90% of global production of salmon in aquaculture. But we did find in Norway, Canada, and the UK, these kind of trends of increasing in frequency and the scale of these events. And so these events are essentially where tens to hundreds of thousands of fish, even millions of fish, will die off in a short period of time. So we had kind of a cutoff of within a month. And in each of the cases, especially for Norway, Canada, and the UK, we're talking about millions of fish dying off in an event.
I mean, that is a lot of fish. Can you help us understand why that is happening? I've been seeing discussions about the heavy reliance on technology on fish farms. What's going on there?
There's a few things going on. One is changing environment. So changing ocean, largely pushed by climate change, makes conditions for growth more variable. And so when you have more variation in ocean temperature, in storm events, in levels of oxygen in the water, it makes things riskier for fish, especially if they're constrained in space. But then the other component is where people choose to grow the fish, how many fish they're growing within these kind of pens. So that's sometimes known as stocking density is another important decision. If more and more fish at higher densities are exposed to environmental variation that's risky to them, they're potentially going to be more and more fish lost all at once. Technological or kind of husbandry concerns that we think are going to increase production, reduce risk, can actually backfire.
Can you give us an example of that? Like, talk a bit more about what the promise of technology has been for salmon farming and where the promise is falling apart.
So the major technologies and practices we're talking about when it comes to salmon aquaculture are innovations that are allowing us to move more offshore. So because of increases in kind of storage and transporting and other kind of aspects of producing the salmon, we're actually growing them in conditions that are more variable. A big issue in salmon aquaculture everywhere is dealing with sea lice. So if you're a producer and you're trying to get rid of sea lice, one way to do it is with chemical or heat treatment. If you do that at the wrong time, such as in kind of a major heat event, that could actually backfire and kill off a bunch of fish.
Yeah, so we've got climate change and technologies being used far offshore for farming just increases the risk and harm for the fish. And yet people want more salmon to eat. What are the solutions to this?
There does need to be more emphasis on kind of greater regulation and especially things that might increase risk-taking in the growth of fish. It's a tough question. Like you said, there's a huge demand for salmon, probably much more than we can sustainably address. And so you can try to address the demand side, but it's really, really hard, especially as more countries around the world get more access to disposable income that allows them to buy fish all year round. It can be really hard to convince people to have a more kind of seasonal diet, for example, or limit their consumption of salmon.
Gerald Tseng is an assistant professor at the University of Victoria in Canada.
Our lives are hectic, often in a rush to the bus, to work, to the grocery store, plugged into our devices. But no matter how distracted we are, there are moments that stop us in our tracks, moments of beauty. The World's Sarah Birnbaum is spending a year in Sydney, Australia with her family and sent us this dispatch about one of those moments at the International Airport in Adelaide.
I was traveling with my husband and two kids, and we were going to this place called Kangaroo Island. You have to take two planes to get there. And I was dreading this layover and having to bribe and then threaten and then bribe my kids to get them to the next gate. So my head's down, you know, was scowling, steeling myself for this slog, when I heard something I didn't expect. The cello at the Adelaide International Airport in front of Boost Juice. The musician is William Jack. lanky guy in his 20s in a baseball cap and jeans. He's a classically trained cellist with a love of rock music and the blues. Jack sits alone on the concourse in a hard plastic chair, which must have been appropriated from the food court. His beaten-up instrument case is covered in stickers from all over the world. Basel, Hong Kong, Zurich, London, Dubai, Austin. Jack says he's usually touring, but when he's home in Adelaide, he'll pick up paid gigs like this one. He says maybe this is his third or fourth time playing at the airport.
It's definitely something you get used to as a musician. It's our favorite settings, of course, are when the entire audience is listening. That's a real treat. But but you have to get used to playing where you're in a bar and there's a lot of background noise and things like that. And an airport's no different. Obviously, everyone's busy getting ready for their flights and rushing to the gates and stuff like that. But it's kind of nice just to have a little bit of music to alter that setting,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. Do the gate announcements get in the way?
They're a little bit annoying.
The live music is funded by the airport and organized by Music SA, the advocacy group for South Australia's music industry. CEO Christine Schloide says the concerts have been going on for 10 years now. It's always local talent, and they're encouraged to play their own songs.
And what it is just an opportunity to showcase the depth and breadth of original talent in South Australia and bring a sense of joy and creativity to passerbys as they're moving through the airport.
Mission accomplished. I spent the rest of the layover dancing with my three-year-old. And thank goodness the airport wasn't too crowded because she wanted to do those aerial lifts like at the end of Dirty Dancing with a running start. In the food court, a maintenance crew on their coffee break stopped chatting to smile at us. A woman on her way to Hobart stopped to take a video of Jack on her phone. And then we went to the gate. The trip to Kangaroo Island ended up being pretty fun. We saw some beautiful beaches, snuggled a koala. But one of my favorite memories was dancing with my daughter in Terminal 1 while a young musician from Adelaide picked out some grooves on his cello. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum, Sydney.
You're listening to The World. When a driver in Kosovo came across an abandoned brown bear cub on the side of the road, he knew who to call.
Right away, he found our contact, and I was like, I have found a bear cub, and I don't know what to do with it.
We'll visit a bear sanctuary in Kosovo's capital that's saving the animals. Ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. It is hard to believe, but 4 days after Islamic extremists abducted around 200 women and children in the northeast of Nigeria, there's been another brazen kidnapping. This one's different, though. It happened in the northwest Kaduna state of Nigeria. The kidnappers did not appear to be connected with any rebel group. Instead, they would appear to be more like bandits. They were riding motorcycles, toting guns, and swept into a village as the school day was beginning. Philip Obagi Jr. is a correspondent for the Daily Beast. He's based in Nigeria. So if this was a group of bandits carrying out this most recent kidnapping, is it only about trying to collect ransom money, or is there something else going on here?
Here in Nigeria, we refer to bandits as, you know, criminal elements, gunmen who are perhaps, you know, kidnappers and what have you. Yeah, it's mostly about ransom. You know, Nigeria is facing many issues in the country economically. We have fuel prices, you know, increasing by over 400% since subsidy for petroleum products were removed last May. If we have a local currency that is really crashing against the dollar, bad economy, poverty rising, and what have you. So crime has actually increased, you know, to unprecedented levels in Nigeria, especially in the north of the country.
And the children, how young are they?
Well, over 100 of them were under 12 years of age. About 200 of these kids children who are in their teenage age.
Philip, what has the Nigerian government said about the kidnapping so far?
The president deployed over 250 troops to comb the forest in Kaduna State in search of these kids. And I heard just yesterday that the government of Kaduna State, where Kuriga is located, have begun to negotiate with the bandits, even though the spokesperson for the government came out later on to deny that that's happening. But in the past, we know that local governments have been in negotiation with bandits over the release of the people that they have kidnapped. But so far, the military is still in the forest in Kaduna State, combing in search of the abducted school children.
Does the government have an idea where these kidnapping victims actually are?
They haven't said that publicly. I have been in touch, you know, just a few hours ago with some of my contacts in the police in Kaduna State. And they say they are still searching. They haven't gotten any lead yet as to, you know, where these kids have been kept and who exactly is responsible for the attack.
Philip, I'm curious about the rapid sequence of these incidents of kidnapping since last week. I mean, barely days apart, and many abductions of women and children. Has this been seen before at this scale and speed in Nigeria?
Not really. We know that in the past, what we have seen in the past are kidnappings happening at intervals, maybe, you know, in between months or weeks. But in just a matter of days, we've had children kidnapped by gunmen from a school in the northwestern state of Kaduna. And then, you know, a few days earlier, there were about 200 people, mostly women and children, who were kidnapped in the northeastern state of Borno. And whenever we hear about kidnappings in the northeast, the first thought goes to Boko Haram, like, because this is the area where Boko Haram, the Islamic State, West Africa province, are very, very active. So
right.
It's very likely that kidnappings in Borno State was carried out by an Islamist group. But we haven't seen, to answer your question, we haven't seen this kind of situation happen successfully, no, quite closely. And one of the things that we were worried about is the fact that Nigeria is facing its worst crisis, perhaps in history, economically, I mean, where people can hardly survive in terms of being able to afford food to eat, able to transport themselves and what have you. And not many people in Nigeria are surprised at what's going on because the hardship keeps increasing on a daily basis. Inflation has gotten to another level, levels that we've never seen before. Incidents like this may even continue going forward.
Philip, how fragile is the Nigerian state right now?
It is very fragile because the biggest problem we have, like I said, is insecurity. It is affecting everyone. We're seeing protests across major cities in Nigeria, you know, as we speak. And it's never happened in this scale, you know, not in my lifetime, where people have had to hit the streets in different cities asking for solutions to the hardship the country is facing. You know, economic instability, poverty, food insecurity, actually are all part of problems of general insecurity. When this begins to grow, people fear for their safety because when people are angry and are hitting the streets and when people are angry and are finding all possible means to survive, that poses enormous problems in terms of the security of the nation in general. So Nigeria is in a very fragile state as we speak.
Philip Obagi Jr. is a correspondent for The Daily Beast. He's based in Nigeria. Philip, thank you as always. Good to speak with you.
A pleasure, Marco. Thank you for having me.
We have an update for you on a constitutional referendum held in Ireland on Friday. As we reported last week, voters were asked if language in two sections of the Irish Constitution should be changed. One passage up for reconsideration is about women's duties being in the home. The other proposed change would have broadened the definition of the family beyond marriage. Both measures were defeated, and to the surprise of many, the final vote wasn't even close.
Ireland's Prime Minister Leo Varadkar said, "It was our responsibility to convince the majority of people to vote yes, and we clearly failed to do so." The Irish Constitution was ratified in 1937, a time when the Catholic Church had major influence over political and social life in Ireland. Surveys show that a majority wants to change the wording of the Constitution, but critics say the government's proposals were confusing. Others say the amendments did not go far enough. A nonprofit called the National Women's Council of Ireland expressed disappointment about the no vote and said it's a wake-up call not to be complacent about equality and women's rights.
Here's a success story about a nationwide conservation effort in Kosovo. The small Balkan nation wants to protect its population of indigenous bears and put a stop to the practice of keeping them in cages for people's entertainment. In recent years, dozens of bears have been rescued. The World's Jury Buscarin visited a bear sanctuary outside Kosovo's capital to learn more.
The Four Paws Animal Sanctuary near Pristina focuses on bears. They take care of a lion named Joni, too. But it's stray dogs who come up to greet Tolant Hoxha when he walks up the hill.
People usually dump here by the lake, and then they know that there is food here, so we just see, like, in front of our doors every day.
Such is life when you're an animal sanctuary in the forested mountains of Kosovo. Every Monday, Hoxha takes his camera and visits the bears. They have names, best friends, individual personalities. This one, named Andre, has light brown fur, almost a sandy blonde. He comes right up to the fence when Hoxha calls his name.
Andre. Andre. Ah.
Andre was rescued 5 years ago when a driver found an orphaned cub on the side of the road.
Then he right away found our contact and I was like, I have found a bear cub. And I don't know what to do with it.
The Four Paws Sanctuary took Andre in. This 40-acre sanctuary provides fenced-in habitats that are much larger than a traditional zoo, and similar to the environments the bears would have been born into. High-altitude oak forest, meadows with wildflowers. There are pools to swim in and tunnel-like structures for a snooze. Andre's the kind of bear that will play with anything, even the wild snakes he finds in the dirt. But without the teachings of a mother bear, Andre hasn't been hibernating. Every winter, the sanctuary staff has to find a solution for him.
Because he's not digging his den, so we give the chance, like, to go inside, like, in this house. Mm-hmm. There are boxes inside, and it's warmer, of course. So when it's snowy or very cold, he has a place, like, to go inside.
In most cases, the sanctuary has rescued bears from private owners. Until just a few years ago, it was fairly common for restaurants in Kosovo, Serbia, and Albania to keep bears in cages as a kind of attraction. Hoxha himself remembers visiting two of these bears as a child in his hometown of Prizren.
It became a trend to visit this place because that's a zoo, like that's what we were told. And of course, as a kid, that you're kind of enthusiastic to see any kind of wild animal, that looked okay.
It would have been a terrifying existence for the bears, which the sanctuary recreates in a mock cage with a sound system. Some bears were trained to drink beer or do tricks for visitors. One, named Stevie, went blind after being injured in a fight with another bear.
I don't know, like, in the best cases, maybe 10 square meter cage, like... exposed in snow, sun, rain.
After a few years at the sanctuary, Hoxha says Stevie is noticeably calmer and gets regular medical care. Kosovo outlawed the private ownership of bears in 2010, just a couple years after declaring independence from Serbia. Today, 20 bears live at the Four Paws Sanctuary. Two of them, Ari and Rina, are the same bears that Hoxha saw in captivity as a child. Though they're currently hibernating, he proudly shows me their photo at the visitor center, walking through a forest.
Especially spring and summer, it's like they're so hyperactive.
As the director of communications, Hoxha's job is to make these bears a national project. He posts their photos on social media with little updates about what they did that day. They're like his friends.
All have different favorite foods, different favorite spots in their enclosures.
45,000 visitors come through here every year. Hoxha is fairly confident that there are no bears currently being kept illegally in the country because people are so likely to call in if they suspect it. He says saving the bears is something that Kosovo can be proud of, as a poor country still recovering from a brutal war in the late 1990s.
And if we can make it this small positive story to be among this long list of issues that are presented on daily basis, I'm proud of that. Because at least we have something to show that we have done something right.
For The World, I'm Dari Buscarin. Pristina, Kosovo.
A former American ally has been convicted in a New York court on drug trafficking charges. Juan Orlando Hernandez is also the former president of Honduras. He now faces a mandatory prison term of at least 40 years. His brother, Tony Hernandez, is already serving a life sentence in the U.S. for drug smuggling. Security analyst Lester Ramirez in the Honduran capital, Tegucigalpa, says the latest verdict comes as a relief.
There is a little bit of shame, of course, that the other countries have to intervene and resolve issues. But of course, I understand that the justice system here is corrupt and controlled and captured by not only, you can say, narco traffickers, but also, most importantly, by political parties. So in the scenario that he would be tried here, I don't think that he would be found guilty. I don't think even been trialed in the first place.
For more on the story of Juan Orlando Hernandez, I reached out to Stephen Dudley. He's the co-founder of the media organization Insight Crime and has been following the case closely. I began by asking about the testimony that led to this conviction.
It was a combination of drug traffickers and others who had either worked closely with him or been convicted alongside other parts of the network. And they had some documentation that indicated that Juan Orlando himself may have been directly involved in what was a really elaborate drug trafficking network that extended across mostly the sort of entire northern coast of Honduras.
And the former president apparently used his own military and national police to protect drug shipments. Is that right?
There are various parts of the police and the military that were directly implicated in drug trafficking activities. And it was certainly implied that he was directing some of this.
This all happened at the same time that Honduras was receiving millions of dollars from the U.S. to crack down on drug trafficking. How long did it take for U.S. officials to figure out that the president was actually working hand in hand with drug traffickers?
Well, there is this kind of myth that the United States is this monolith, that all these different parts of the government are working hand in hand. And that certainly has been illustrated to be false as it related to Honduras. There's a part of the government, the Justice Department, that was working on this case or that went back years to the point where when he was elected, so we're talking about 2013, 2014, the investigation goes back to implicating his brother and family members in the network itself. So it went back that far for the Justice Department. In the meantime, he was doing things that the State Department and even parts of the Justice Department were in favor of, going after and extraditing numerous large-scale drug traffickers. So there was this bit of this sort of parallel paths that were happening simultaneously, the investigation on the part of the Justice Department, and then the work that Juan Orlando was doing to placate the United States over many, many years. And then when another government came in, the Trump administration, the government knew how to placate him by, for example, moving the embassy in Israel. So things like that were able to keep him in good stead with the United States, even though he was being investigated by the Justice Department.
So was this a case of the right hand not knowing what the left was doing, in this case, state and the judiciary departments? Or was it just what kind of allow some of this activity to happen if he's cooperating in other ways?
It's a great question, and I wish we knew the answer to it. And part of the answer we had hoped would come out in this trial, but there were certain documents that were held off of the docket and that were not released publicly that could have shed light on what they knew and when they knew it. Because that's kind of the big question lingering still. And if you are working with an administration, a regime that is connected to drug trafficking, why not break off those relations? So that is a lingering question.
And so why was the former president able to be extradited from Honduras and put on trial here in the U.S.?
To a certain extent, it was timing. The opposition candidate had won, and the Biden administration had also come into power. So both of these things kind of aligned so that there could be a trial. We're not talking about something that happens very often, of course. I mean, the last one being Noriega, the former military dictator in Panama. So this is not something the Justice Department takes lightly, and I don't expect it to continue in other cases either.
So as you mentioned, this is not the first time a Central American leader has faced trial in the U.S. You mentioned General Manuel Noriega, the former leader of Panama. A U.S. jury found him guilty back in 1992. In the decades since then, have judicial systems in Central America changed much?
And in some respects, yes. There's a lot more special units to deal with things like drug trafficking, like money laundering, in certain cases, gangs and violence. So there's a lot of new units. But they're facing a lot of the same challenges they were facing way back in the 90s, which are very political. Who names the attorney general? Who does the attorney general name to be the head of the forensics department? Who does the attorney general name to be the head of the wiretap system that they're getting into listen to telephone calls? All of those things matter if you want to build cases. And you can't build cases if you don't have the political will. So it really starts at the top. And unless you have that, then you're not going to get these big cases tried in these countries.
Stephen Dudley is the co-founder of Insight Crime. He was talking about the drug trafficking conviction of the former president of Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernandez. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. A big night at the Oscars for Oppenheimer and also for our own production partners here at GBH Boston at Frontline, who, in collaboration with the Associated Press, won Best Documentary for their astounding account of a Ukrainian city under siege by the Russian military. 20 Days in Mariupol is a kind of film that brings the horrors of war alive. You don't just hear the explosions, you feel them too. No sound effects in this film.
In feature films, though, sound designers carefully add elements to a film's soundtrack to create a specific mood. We've got two examples for you. The Zone of Interest portrays the life of a Nazi commandant and his family as they live next door to the Auschwitz concentration camp. It won an Oscar last night for Best Sound Design, not to mention Best International Feature Film. Another nominee in that category, Society of the Snow, portrays the survivors of an infamous plane crash in the Andes in the late 70s. The World's Jerry Haddon recently reported on the approach taken by both films to maximize the impact of sound in telling their stories.
Some sound for film gets recorded in the field, say in nature. Sometimes the designer has to invent it. Like this sound from Society of the Snow. It comes early in the film when the plane crashes and the broken fuselage skids across a vast snowfield. To create that, sound designer Oriol Tarrego constructed this.
This is the fuselage we built, and we make, and then we have this.
Tarrego's showing me around his Barcelona studios. His mini fuselage is an aluminum box about the size of half a magician's coffin. It's a sled, actually. Tarrego and his team took it to the Pyrenees, covered it with mics, and pushed it down a snowy slope over and over. For texture, they filled it with pieces of metal, a pan,
a cowbell.
Tarrego threw in a Tibetan prayer bowl for some eerie bass. Over months of experimenting, he amassed a sound library that would bring the fuselage itself to life, which in the end is a sound designer's job, to bring films to life. Society of the Snow made that challenging because, crash aside, there wasn't a ton of sound to exploit. High up in the Andes, there's wind, snow. That's basically it. No birds or other animals. So Tarrego set out to make the wind speak to viewers, like in this scene where it whistles through the broken plane as survivors inside shiver uncontrollably. Tarrego shows me his noisemaker. It's a hollow metal tube about 2 feet long. He took it up to a mountain pass in the Pyrenees, he says, during a night of strong gusts.
When the wind goes going through the tube, was making like this whoo, and there was like another a pendant holder, and that has like some holes on it, and it was making like this sound. And then that sound is like one of the very characteristic sound of the fuselage during the night.
This is the result, a haunting, relentless lament, a natural soundtrack, you might say, mirroring the survivor's own torment. Bringing the snow to life was even tougher, because snow alone is silent. It only makes noise when you walk on it. If it's hard packed in a scene, you need it to sound like
this kind of a crush, crush, crush.
For when the men walk around the wrecked fuselage, for example, But when the survivors try to cross the valley, the snow changes.
It sounds like...
Crusty on top, deep powder beneath. To find those exact conditions and record them, Tarregós searched for 2 winters, both in the Andes and in Europe.
There's like this moment of the walking, and you can see the feet of the... And then actually all that work was just actually for that 2 footsteps.
Wow. 2 winters to cover 2 seconds of the film. That's it. Scene over. I asked Tarrego if he ever feels tempted to just use some online sound library. Type in deep snow, click to download, take the afternoon off.
Somebody who's not into sound might just say, why go to so much trouble to create that footstep? Is the audience going to really notice somehow that the sound is off?
To me, the film is trying to make an experience. And when you have the right sound for the right picture and the right moment, everything combines. And the experience, it's different. The audience just gets so into it.
Getting the audience immersed, Tarrego's technique painstakingly matching what you hear with what you see. But in another film this year, The Zone of Interest has an even bigger job. The Zone of Interest tells the story of a Nazi commander and his family at the Auschwitz concentration camp in Poland during World War II. A single wall separates the family from the camp's round-the-clock atrocities, gassings, shootings, incinerations. But you never see any of it. You, like the family, only hear it, to devastating effect. Sporadic gunfire, barking dogs, distant shouting, the hum of the ovens. It's a grim sound palette running relentlessly through the film. Sometimes it's inseparable from the daily life of the family. Like during this birthday party scene outdoors, intertwined with the squeals of the German children splashing in a pool, the shrieks of Jews presumably being gassed.
I would say it's the most violent film I've ever worked on.
Johnny Byrne designed the sound. He was speaking recently at a film festival in Santa Barbara. He says rather than employing sound to confirm what your eyes see, he used it to suggest.
I think what it does is we all have a collective knowledge of what happened there, you know, and this film draws through sound upon that and paints pictures on your head, in your head, you know, and we know that you can close your eyes, but you can't close your ears.
That's what drives the film's narrative tension, and the tension among viewers trying to square the Nazi family's mundane life on camera with the off-camera horror. Except for an opening minimalist overture, the film has no music. The score in Society of the Snow is kept to a minimum, too, which suits sound designer Oriol Tarrego. He says as they were finishing the film, it became clear that adding music would actually take away from certain parts of the story.
These moments that very, like, hard, difficult emotions, at the end we decided to not put like any sound or any music on it because you don't tell the audience what they have to feel.
Like just as the plane is set to make impact with the mountainside, the pilot's trying to gain altitude, the whine of the engines is rising, and it's just a beat. But it causes the sound that follows to resonate more deeply with the audience, to transport them into the scene, which is all a sound designer could ask for. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Be good to each other out there and join us right back here tomorrow.